This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Chris Holmes, and this is Burned by Books. Here you'll find interviews with writers you already love, like Jennifer Egan and Rebecca Mackay, mixed in with up-and-coming voices like Alexandra Kleeman and Ruman Alam. You'll find us wherever you listen to podcasts, but check out previous episodes at burnedbybooks.com. and on Instagram and Twitter at Burned by Books. Let's start the show. In Scott Alexander Howard's wonderful debut novel, The Other Valley, the denizens of a valley town are hemmed in by highly controlled borders to the east and west. For those lucky enough to cross the border, they will encounter their exact world 20 years in the past, should they go west, and 20 years in the future, if they go east. An elaborate governance system has been set up to arbitrate rare crossings, almost exclusively set aside for families mourning loved ones who have passed away. It is a chance to see them living in their past lives one more time. But the families cannot interact with their loved ones, nor can they be recognized, for such identifications can change the past, present, and future, making individuals into non-beings. The Other Valley introduces us to Odile Ozan, a teenager whose smarts and rule-following make her a candidate to join the council that judges all petitions for crossing the valleys. Her schoolmates largely see their futures as fixed, destined for one of the menial lower-class jobs that serve the council's needs. But a budding romance with a young man named Edme puts Odile on an unexpected path that collides her own future with Edme's truncated present. Odile will have to choose between a life of comparative ease and prestige and an illegal crossing that might remove her entirely from the continuum of time. Aptly compared to the work of Ishiguro and Atwood, The Other Valley works a spell with its reserved mood and hauntingly repressive speculative world. It asks us to imagine the choices we might have made if given a return to a moment from our past. And in asking, it suggests our lives are better understood as inescapably intertwined with the past and futures of others. Scott Alexander Howard lives in Vancouver, British Columbia. He has a PhD in philosophy from the University of Toronto and was a postdoctoral fellow at Harvard, where his work focused on the relationship between memory, emotion, and literature. The Other Valley is his first novel. Welcome to Burned by Books, Scott.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. It's great to be here.
Well, I'm really excited to talk about this book. I loved it. I loved living with Odile and getting to exist in this world that you made. I'm wondering, can you tell us a bit about how this novel came into being for you? What sparked your interest in the idea of seeing oneself across a time continuum? And how did Odile's voice come to you?
Well, thank you. I think I know where I was when the image came to me. This is one of those premises that kind of just like showed up fully formed one day. You know, not the entire story, but the idea of the world of these time staggered towns was kind of just a thought out of the blue. I didn't do anything with it for a long time. This thought first came maybe 10 years ago this year, actually. And it was while my friends and I were waiting for another one of our friends to pass away. She was in hospice. She had cancer. And I was trying to help her sister arrange final visits for sort of people who are kind of on the outer concentric rings of the circle of grief, you know, like people like me and mm-hmm. some other friends who are, you know, not the people who are going to be in the room, but who still wanted to see her and knew that if she was up to it, that she'd want to see us. But things progressed too quickly. And so most of us didn't get those final visits. Mm-hmm. And it was during that time, you know, those kind of awful days where you're just sort of, you know, checking your email and just watching your phone, that this thought just suddenly struck me, you know, this kind of naturalization of time travel, where time travel is just geographical, kind of terrestrial travel. And there's these towns that just kind of proceed east and west forever in either direction, presumably. And I think that the reason that time travel has always been used in this book, primarily for mourning, owes to that personal context of, you know, when I had the idea. But it actually, ironically, took me a long time to see the connection. I kind of just thought it was a random thought at the time mm-hmm. and didn't have any bearing one way or the other on that context. But it was kind of a period of my life when there was a lot of, you know, we had lost another friend barely a year before, and my wife had a dream about her after she passed, where, you know, she got to see her again. And it was one of those kind of odd death dreams that are familiar to many of us, where the dead person is alive and well again, but they have now the status of being dead. Like, you're kind of aware of it in the dream too. And so you don't know whether to tell them. And a lot of people find these dreams kind of strange or you know, upsetting. I have. But my wife's dream, she kind of came out of it and she was just so grateful to have seen her friend again. And I think that reaction kind of stuck with me. The idea of, you know, this one last look being so meaningful.
Mm. That's so interesting that there's a real deep well of personal interaction with mourning that undergirds it. And certainly I've thought many times, especially after the death of my mother, about what would the opportunity be like to see the person that we've lost one more time. Although I would say that the other valley does not necessarily leave me with the sense that that would be a great experience, but So the novel is a time travel novel that breaks kind of all the literary rules that we have for a genre of time travel. There aren't any machines or high-toned science experiments that fling characters in a difficult way across time. One walks across, as you said, a geographical boundary, and suddenly you're precisely 20 years before or after your present moment. Nearly every event that happened in one's life can then be viewed by moving west. And your own future exists in the east. How did you approach the challenge of moving across time without a lot of the tropes and baggage of what we think of as kind of harder science fiction?
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, it's not a challenge because you just don't do those things. You know, you just kind of relinquish those and then see what happens. I mean, it was fairly easy to kind of write it very straight. I think that was one of the commitments at the start, was to sort of grant myself the one strange premise, and, you know, which is these time staggered valleys and towns, and then spool out everything from there in a very logical and rational way. So it really was just a matter of saying, well, you know, if the world was like this, what kind of political systems would arise? How would people emotionally cope with it? So I feel like a lot of it was just kind of given in my imagination. I did kind of enjoyed breaking some of those rules. I'm glad that you noticed it. I think that, you know, and in fact, I've been talking to some other people about when they first hear the premise of the book, they're like, oh, but it's time travel. I don't really like time travel. And then they say, but there's no machine. And they're like, oh, okay. I don't know what the hang up of the machine is, but it was kind of nice to just see what happened if you went without it. And I think another distinction between this and some regular time travel tropes is that there's no temporal culture clash. You know, that was a choice mm-hmm. that I made pretty early on, that I didn't want to rely heavily on, you know, I guess the Back to the Future is kind of the era example of this, where, you know, the 80s kid goes to the 50s and, you know, jokes ensue, basically.
Don't forget Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
You know, Bill and Ted, I think it's an underrated time travel film. Bill and Ted actually make some pretty... there's actually one, I can't get into it without spoiling things, but there's one part of this book where in my notes I was like, gotta avoid the Bill and Ted problem. That was the nickname for this in my research, was this one kind of time travel device that they use that I didn't want to use.
What, you'll have to tell me that off air, so okay. We can save the spoil, but I'm very interested in that. And I also am interested, I don't know how much say you had in the cover, but I love the way that it sort of, it depicts folds of what I think of as the time-space continuum. And I think that's the way a lot of kind of people invested in theories of time-space think about it, as a kind of folding over of time and space, so that they touch each other in interesting ways that break our sense of chronology. And I wonder what your relationship is to the image.
Yeah, the image was, this is one of those cases where I came to the publisher with, you know, a Pinterest full of ideas that I had, and they were like, okay, cool. Here's something that's totally not like that. And I was like, yeah, that's better. So, you know, sometimes you gotta trust the people whose job it is. I think that, but then once they kind of, so Leiwan Kwan is the cover designer for this, and she did a great job. And I think that once the concept of kind of taking one sort of pastoral bucolic image and then disfiguring it on the sides with these folds, once that concept was in place, then I did have a lot of say in like the nature of the painting and, you know, the nature of the figures who are standing in the corners. So it was pretty collaborative.
Well, I think it matches beautifully. And that's not always the case. Even sometimes I'll like a cover and think that it's not a great match for it. But it certainly made me think more about how this sort of folding of time and space would work. We should talk about the structure of the society and government in the Other Valley. There's a highly regimented schooling system for children that essentially goes up to what we'd think of as like American high school level. And at that point, teachers select a small number of students to attend a special government school that will cull out a handful of students to become part of what you call the council or conseil. That determines all movement between the folds of time to the east and west. All other students are then sorted into labor that serves the council, including the gendarmerie, the police of the borders. It's clear you're drawing from a bunch of different philosophies of governance and community and making up some of your own. And I'd love to know the sort of theoretical background for this society.
You know, I think that was also kind of something that I just thought was, well, okay. I mean, the first thing I wanted to say was that the operations of the Conseil, I think, were kind of, again, to me, entailed by the world where they live. You know, I realized, well, okay, the first thoughts that I had about the book, I was like, you know what, this is not going to be one of those books where there's, you know, like fences and walls and guards patrolling the, you know, the timelines. And people are going to be able to walk back and forth freely. And I'm going to, you know, play out the implications of that. And then within a few days, I thought, you know what, that's not going to work. You know, it's not going to fly. And so the operations of the Conseil and the kind of very forbidding borders that they put up between these valleys to prevent movement, at least unauthorized movement, that again just seemed to me kind of entailed by their circumstances. Because, you know, as you were saying at the beginning, if you go back in time and monkey around, that's a time travel trope that is, you know, I think just logically entailed by, you know, the situation, you're going to undo yourself in some way. And so I thought of the kind of authoritarian streak in their society as somewhat plausible and somewhat necessary. And it's been interesting to hear people's reactions to the book where they think that the Conseil is purely evil because, you know, it does some evil things and it tells some lies. I can spoil that much. But I do kind of wonder, well, how else would this society be organized given the genuine risks that travel would pose? You know, so I have a little bit more of kind of a morally gray view of their operations, to be honest.
Yeah, you would have to set up a fairly repressive system if you didn't want people constantly disappearing.
Yes. Yeah. So, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that I found it not a neutral organization for sure, but not neutral in the way that when you invest a group of people with an extraordinary amount of power over a majority group, it very often, you know, kind of descends into some of the uglier aspects of repressive governance. But that seems almost like organic to those styles of governance. But at the same time, it felt like there was this very necessary piece for this society and that they couldn't do without it.
Yeah, I think that there was, you know, occasionally I felt uncomfortable, you know, as a person when writing this story, that the kind of authority invested in them seemed to some degree justified in the world that I was creating. And so I thought, you know, am I creating this kind of justification for authoritarian border policies and so forth, things that I don't believe in as a citizen of our world, the things which nonetheless seemed, you know, inevitable in their world, at least, if not justified in some moral sense, but just kind of, this is the way it would be there.
Odile is such a wonderful character. She's very easy to love and to empathize with, but not because she's unerringly good. And there are key moments in the story in which she acts with pure selfishness. In particular, the illegal crossing of Lucy puts Odile to a moral test, which she seems to fail. I don't ever want or need characters to be saints or saintly, but I'd love to hear more about your choices when you were thinking about Odile's morality as a central question for the novel.
Well, that's a really good question. I think that what you see in the second half of the book, which, just to give some context, the first half of the book follows Odile when she's 16, and then the second half of the book jumps forward to when she's about to turn 36. So there's a big kind of temporal seam in the novel. And I think that what you see in part two is a kind of moral disfigurement that is a consequence of some of the choices or lack of choices that Odile made in the first part of the book, you know. So we're seeing these ramifications kind of come home. I also think I have a certain sympathy for Odile, even when she's making these bad decisions, because she's making them from a very subjugated kind of place. And it's not as though she's committing cruelties just in a wanton way. She's also herself in desperate straits. And so we see her rationalizing the decisions that she's making. And we know that it's not entirely that she's maybe lying to herself as she does so. But it's also, these are kind of ways of thinking that I think she would probably have, because she needs to make these decisions to get herself out of this situation that she's in.
And she also has like countless different pressures on her, societal pressures, family pressures, and just, you know, trying to imagine for herself a future that perhaps might be at odds with what she will see of her own future. And those pressures come together to allow a kind of what seems like an active rationalization of some choices that we read in a kind of ironic way as immoral.
Yes. Yeah, I agree. I've heard some responses to the book early on where people said, like, she's such a rule follower, which she is at the start of the book. And people sometimes relate to her because they say, well, I was also kind of the good girl who didn't stick my neck out and, you know, sometimes made choices that were things I now regret because I was kind of towing the line too much of what people's expectations of me were. It's funny, I didn't really set out to write that character. She just kind of came out that way. You know, sometimes you don't have a lot of choice. There's not a lot of intention or kind of deliberate messaging when you're writing. You're just like, this is the person that is presenting themselves to me.
Part one of the novel is, and this is Odile as a 16-year-old, is in many ways a story of institutional schooling in the form of what might be called an abandoned Bildungsroman, where there's never any of that sort of full assimilation into the society. And part two becomes almost a gritty police narrative, with the emphasis on how a subject of a repressed society makes choices that are selfless in order to try and change that system. What was it like moving between these two sections, two genres, really? And what was appealing about splitting the novel in this way?
I think that the primary appeal of splitting the novel on a kind of thematic or emotional level, as opposed to just like a plot mechanics level, was that I wanted to make you miss childhood when you got to part two. I think that Odile is lying to herself and lying to us when she's an adult and she's saying, I don't really think about the past anymore. I think it's pretty evident that she does. And so I wanted to sustain a certain degree of, I don't know, mournfulness in the reader for the first bit of that adulthood that we see of hers. In the same way that I think that she misses childhood, even though she's, you know, not telling us that she does. So I think that that's kind of what I was trying to do with that big time jump, was kind of create that sense of loss in the reader as well. The genre switch, I don't really see it as a generic switch, even though I know exactly what you mean. Like there, we kind of, and I'm seeing, you know, some people talk about it that way as like it's a coming of age that becomes a thriller. I really like gritty police narrative. that I think, again, just kind of was entailed by the situation that I put her into more than anything else. I kind of wanted to, I don't know, you don't hear about it spoken about this way too much. Like usually you just hear like characters determine the story, you know, that's the goal of writing, is for, you know, the character to sort of lead the way. But this does seem to be a case where the character is actually determining the genre itself of the literary work, you know.
Yeah, and that makes a lot of sense with her, you know, joining the gendarme and kind of having to take on the persona that comes with that role. And you have to, you know, act in ways according to the, you know, that your, a lot of your personality in that role is formed by the fact that you are constantly on the border and sometimes puncturing that border. And so that form, the form of the border and its both its physical and illusory sense, kind of gives shape to how Odile acts, and at least at the beginning of that section. So without spoiling too much, Odile is going to, in this second section, make a decision that may or may not break one of these kind of ultimate laws of shifting through time and space. But it is clear that this larger system will still persist in some way. And I was wondering how you thought of the novel and in terms of its, because I think of it as quite hopeful, the novel, and at the same time, it carries an inherent pessimism about how ideologies and repressive systems kind of keep rolling on, even when you have hopeful revolutionary moments.
That's really well put. Yeah, I think that I'm a sucker for the bittersweet. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of one of the tonal aspirations that I have most of the time. And it felt to me as though balancing the kind of hopefulness of the ending with a certain degree of cynicism and, you know, without spoiling things, a certain degree of pessimism about the ultimate achievement that Odile has, that just felt like an appealing kind of place to land. It felt to me true to life. You know, when you were describing that, I also was thinking about the Ishiguro comparison and sort of the Ishiguro inheritance that I have, because it seemed to me like what you were saying does describe what he's been doing lately. And by lately, I mean kind of the last 20 years. You know, he sort of ends these novels like Never Let Me Go and Claire and the Sun with a kind of balancing between maybe a certain kind of naive hope in, you know, the power of love or the power of the sun. With a certain kind of societal cruelty that doesn't recognize that or is indifferent to it or doesn't reward it in some way. So maybe I absorb some of that from him.
Yeah, I thought when I first read that that comparison, I was very excited, and I felt like it did play out in the way that you're describing it. And I certainly think of his novels as always bittersweet. Even personal triumphs are couched in a kind of pessimistic sense of what's happening in the larger world. But I was thinking about how your sort of first part of the novel and representing the lives of students who have a really strained relationship to what seems to be their fated futures really does invoke Never Let Me Go in a strong way. But there's also the style of the novel, which I think derives from Odile's emotional detachment or seeming emotional detachment from some of the key events in her life. It creates an ambient tension that sort of roils underneath the seeming calm of Odile's world with its enigmatic rules about mourning and time. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the mood of the novel and the way in which that sort of the student section may or may not be kind of in conversation with Never Let Me Go.
Well, Never Let Me Go was definitely an influence on the book. I think that there's something just so beguiling about Ishiguro's signature tone. And, the style you were just describing, I think, describes him. You know, he has this kind of, these wonderfully flat, placid surfaces to his sentences, and then these titanic emotions that are moving under those surfaces that often
That's
don't
nicely
break.
Said.
Yeah, but they never break through. So you're just kind of like watching these currents. You can see them transparently, but you're never going to, they don't actually erupt. There's something really powerful about that. That does create a lot of tension, and that's something that I hope that I've learned from. It's just brilliant. It's funny, I actually don't think that Never Let Me Go is my favorite of his books. I think that for me it's...
What's your favorite?
Okay, let's do some rankings. And I'm not a completist. I haven't actually read a few of them, so... But I think that I probably would say that The Remains of the Day and A Pale View of Hills would be my number one. Tied, perhaps.
Pale View of Hills is a hot take. I'm not you'd be in a lonely few, I think. But I like it. I think it's a great novel. Have you read The Unconsoled?
No. So that and The Buried Giant, I have not read.
Well, I think you'll particularly like those two, in part because of your working on mourning and time and literature, but also because the way that time works in The Unconsoled and the sort of the geographic movements that seem to come with kind of time jumps or backwards or forwards. There'll be a lot for you to like, I think.
Yeah, I had a philosophy professor recommend it to me. I've been meaning to read it.
Yeah, I think that's Ishiguro's book to like please the philosophers. So I'm deeply interested in your use of borders in the novel. There are physical borders, there are ideological borders, and there's all these different ways in which the passage via land or water is cut off. And sometimes that it is a deadly border and people die trying to cross. These would-be trespassers are essentially trying to make a better life for themselves and their families. Removing the speculative fiction aspect of it, it feels like the long history of desperate border crossing seeping into the other valley. How do you think about borders and boundaries of all kinds in the novel?
You know, in the novel, I think that the border being the way that it is one of the few times in the book, I think, where I was somewhat consciously playing with symbolism. Most of the time when writing, I was actually kind of trying not to think about, meaning in some grander sense. I was just sort of following story. With the border, I think I was initially responding to a certain kind of hostility in philosophy, which is where I came from before I wrote this, a certain hostility towards thinking about the personal past. So my specialization was, I wrote my dissertation about nostalgia and about sort of literary inflected emotions that you find, in poetry and in fiction, especially kind of high modernism like Proust and Wolf. And I didn't find a lot of purchase. There weren't a lot of people who saw what I was doing as particularly philosophical, and so I had like a lot of, I don't want to overstate it, I had some really strong supporters, but I also had a lot of people in the field who were just like, this isn't philosophy, this feels like literature to me. And I think that there was a real kind of future orientation in especially moral philosophy and moral psychology. Everyone's just talking about, you know, action and giving a kind of very purposive view of the world, whereas my view of the world was so much more interested in the digestion of the past. And so I think that when I was writing this book initially, I took a certain kind of glee in depicting a border between myself and the past that was brutally policed, because it felt to me like, I don't know, in a way, like almost a satire of the sort of hostility that I encountered professionally whenever I would try to talk about memory to people who really didn't want to hear about it.
Well, I think there's so much kind of layered into the way that borders work in the novel, and it's a real pleasure to sort of try and undo those threads and see what comes out of it. I found myself coming back again and again to the scenes of the border and loving the way in which they both kind of reminded me of border crises here in the U.S. and all over the world, but also how they were clearly kind of philosophical kinds of boundaries, mental and otherwise.
Yeah, I think that the kind of, you know, it's also a book about grief. And one of the things about grief is that it's one of these universal experiences that kind of resists articulation, you know, and it's by its nature, it's kind of unfathomable. And I think that part of the world of the novel symbolically is kind of gesturing at that unspeakability too, and particularly the borders. You know, the book was actually sold under the title Grief Border. And then I was told audiences are maybe not going to go for that. I don't know. I always liked it. But I think that, you know, the past going on existing as a living place, but with guards with guns between you and it, and the major taboos in the town about even talking too much about the place beyond the border. I think that that was also maybe kind of gesturing at the unspeakability of grief.
This is a Francophile Anglo novel with names like Alain, Yvrette, Edemé, and Odile, and directions given as Est and Ouest. Even reading a lot of world literature, I don't encounter too many novels, perhaps outside of Québécoises, that have this francophilia in a novel written in English. Can you tell us about the dueling linguistic registers of the Other Valley?
Sure, yeah. I think the answer to this question is kind of overdetermined. I think that there's kind of like a whimsical reason why it first appeared in the book, and then a more functional reason. In a way, my theory of fiction is that there is kind of like on a natural selection model, you know, like there's random mutations, things you just kind of fling into it to see what sticks. And then the stuff that stays is the stuff that's actually doing something for your story, whereas the stuff that is just kind of whimsy, it doesn't function, gets weeded out in subsequent drafts. And I think that the French thing initially kind of got flung in for a few different reasons. One is that I was basing the landscape of this world on the valleys where I grew up, which are in sort of the southern interior of British Columbia, which is not the BC landscape that, if you have an image of it in your head, is actually accurate. We usually think about Vancouver and the Pacific Northwest kind of.
That's what I think of. Yeah.
Yeah. So like what Netflix shows look like, basically. And I think that the part of the province where I grew up, it's actually a pretty rare ecosystem in North America, or at least in Canada. It's the only desert. You know, there's these high kind of sort of shrub steppe and these deep, you know, glacial fjord lakes that are, you know, full of lush orchards at the very bottom, but then quickly become these very arid pine forests. It looks a lot more like the Black Hills or something like that. But when I was traveling around the Southern Mediterranean, I noticed this kind of commonality between, you know, my home landscape and this one. And so when I was writing the book, I started to think about, well, what if, you know, I just started to use some of the naming conventions from this part of the world, in the world that I was building. And I think it was also, so there was kind of that on one hand, and then there was also the fact that I was supporting myself as a copy editor at the time, when I was writing this, because I had left academia at this point. And one of the books I was working on was a history of the cartography of Paris. And so the name Edmé actually comes from, you know, a Parisian city planner. Same with Conseil. I just kind of liked the old fashionedness of those words. that fit the world that I was building. So those are kind of like the whimsical, you know, I'll just try these out in a draft and see if I like them. And I think, though, that they stuck around because I liked how they kind of hovered between realism and something a little bit more otherworldly. You know, like I was trying to create an atmosphere that was deeply familiar, and I didn't want to go all the way into sort of speculative fiction naming conventions, which are names without like an earthly precedent, you know? And I think that that kind of fit the genre of the book, to use a language that's going to be foreign to most readers of this book, at least, you know, Anglo readers, but not so foreign that it's wholly made up or unfamiliar. That kind of just seemed like the sweet spot for me.
Yeah, I agree that they have a feeling of kind of almost antiquitous, and that it, which I like in speculative fictions. I like when you both feel like there's something that's out of the bounds of your realism, but also a kind of old-timiness. And I think the book does a great job kind of, yeah, just even the way schooling happens feels like a much older form of schooling, and the process of being selected, this all feels like our world, but slightly earlier. And then you've got this kind of element of time travel within it that plays with that. So I liked that very much.
Thank you. Yeah, it was kind of fun to take time travel, which is typically a futuristic sort of genre, and render it with a fairly retro kind of vibe instead.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, Scott, I'd love to know what you've been reading recently and whether you have any recommendations you might have for Burned by Books listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been interesting to be kind of part of the publishing cycle for the first time and feel suddenly as though my reading habits are so behind. You know, everybody's always reading the latest stuff, and I'm always reading things from at least a few years ago. There's a couple of things, though, that I'm reading now that are actually, these are the rare cases where I'm up to date on things. And so I'm reading Morgan Talty's forthcoming novel, Fire Exit, which I'm not finished yet, but it's excellent so far. I've been reading a book called Silver Repetition by Lily Wang. It's a Canadian novel. It's very lyrical, also very good. And I think also for a list that I was writing about some Canadian stuff, a philosopher and poet in Canada named Jan Zwicky, who's also a friend of mine, a teacher of mine, one of my first philosophy teachers. I've been rereading some of her poetry, including a book called The Long Walk, and just blown away by it again. You know, it's very much dealing with ecological collapse and exploring the kind of complexities of our reactions to it. So that's the one that I would maybe most strongly recommend, that your listeners probably won't have heard about, because it's, sure, stuff doesn't make it across the border as much, but it's just so good. The Long Walk by Jan Zwicky.
I don't know any of these, and I'm excited to seek them out. I want to very much recommend The Other Valley, which absolutely absorbed me, and I found myself so endeared to Odile and her world. And it was a real treat to get to talk to you about it, Scott.
Thank you so much. It was great to talk to you too.
Yeah, thanks so much. Well, that's all from me for now. My thanks to Scott Alexander Howard for coming on to talk about his marvelous debut novel, The Other Valley. You can find links to purchase The Other Valley and all of Scott's recommended books at the website, burnedbybooks.com. There you'll find all of our previous episodes, links to buy a podcast t-shirt, and ways to get in contact. As you listen, take a moment to rate the show on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, this has been Burned by Books.